The Hoopheads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Let me take a moment to let everyone know about the upcoming BTS Summit in St. Louis on September 27th and 28th. If you haven't heard, BTS is a comprehensive program for running a long-term, profitable, high-quality youth basketball training company. It allows someone to have a career in youth basketball, helping young people become the best they can be both on and off the court. I am honored to have Larry Hughes, 13-year NBA veteran and a co-founder of BTS, here to tell us what this summit is all about. Larry, tell us about the upcoming summit and what it's all about.
Mike, thanks and congratulations on your Hoopheads podcast. We established the summit to provide people interested in building a successful youth basketball program the opportunity to come in for 2 days of learning what we do, how we do it, and how they can apply our system to grow their programs. In March, I opened up our 16,000 square foot facility with leading technology used by several NBA teams, which tracks every shot, every movement on the court, allowing us to objectively assess the progress of our members. People who join the summit will get a chance to use the technology and learn how we integrate it into our programs. We will have David Martin, recently head analytics of the 76ers, speak about direction of technology in basketball. We will also have presentations and workshops on how to effectively build back office systems to create memorable experiences for members and build long-term value in the business. We want to empower the attendees to take their basketball organizations to the next level. So the first 30 signups get to participate for free. Thereafter, it's $199 per person. We have arranged discounted hotels in the area. The event also offers the opportunity to network with others in similar circumstances. We're excited to provide this opportunity to market and think that all attendees will get extraordinary value for attending.
Larry, the summit sounds great. Where can people go to learn more and get signed up?
They can go to basketballtrainingsystems.com/summit to learn more or call us at 301-602-3001.
Thanks, Larry. I'm hoping to make it out to St. Louis myself.
The intangibles are very important, especially, you know, from to me, and they always have been, you know, because I truly believe that the intangibles are the separators.
Kevin Sutton is entering his second season with Rhode Island in 2019 after officially being named to David Cox's staff in July of 2018. Sutton comes to Rhode Island after spending the last two seasons at Pitt. He has 11 seasons of coaching at the collegiate level, including stops at Georgetown, George Washington, James Madison, and Old Dominion. A coaching veteran with 33 years of experience, Sutton has spent three different stints coaching for USA Basketball. He was an assistant coach for 2 years at the Hoop Festival for the East, helping the junior development team win gold at the FIBA Americas tournament in Argentina. He also was the head coach for the Nike USA Basketball Hoop Summit, which showcased the top 10 international players against the top 10 U.S. players. In addition to his collegiate coaching experience, Sutton coached at five nationally ranked high school programs: Flint Hill Prep from 1988 to 1990, Harker Prep from 90 to 92, St. John's Prospect Hall from 92 to 98, Montrose Christian, and Montverde Academy from 2004 to 2011, amassing a 489-102 record and winning two national championships. In 1998, he was the associate head coach on the USA Today Super 25 national championship team, and in 2007, he was the head coach of the Montverde Academy Hoops.com national championship team. At Montverde Academy, Sutton coached seven nationally ranked teams and compiled a 186-33 record, while turning out 55 Division I scholarship athletes and three All-America selections. Sutton has built a reputation of being an outstanding teacher of the game of basketball, helping more than 130 student-athletes earn college scholarships at all levels. Sutton also has more than 20 years of coaching experience at every level of basketball camps and clinics, including the Nike Hoops Jamboree, Nike All-America Camp, Michael Jordan Flight School, and the LeBron James Skills Academy, among others. A 1988 graduate of James Madison, Sutton was a three-year letter winner for the Dukes as a player. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a five-star rating and review. Believe it or not, those ratings help your friends and colleagues find the show. If you really love what you're hearing, recommend the Hoopheads Pod to someone and get them to join you as a part of Hoopheads Nation. Be prepared to learn from one of the best in the game, and make sure you have a notebook handy so you can take some notes while you listen to this episode with Coach Kevin Sutton from the University of Rhode Island.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Lindsay here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. Tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from the University of Rhode Island, Kevin Sutton. Kevin, welcome.
Hey guys, I really appreciate you having me on. Really super excited about this opportunity to do this podcast with you.
We're thankful to have you on, get a chance to talk to you about the very diverse things that you've done in the game, both as a player and then your vast experience as a coach at all different levels and in all different types of positions. And we're going to dig into all that as we go through the evening. But I want to start out by going back to how you fell in love with the game of basketball when you were a young kid. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I was very fortunate to grow up in the Washington, D.C. area where basketball is one of the top sports, a hotbed for basketball players. And I had two uncles who were really good players, and they really taught me how to play the game of basketball. And so I fell in love with it, at a very young age. I was very fortunate enough to, like I said, live in a time, in an area, in a community where, basketball was probably the best sport to play. My first cousin, Tommy Amaker, who's the head coach at, Harvard University, was my backcourt mate from age seven, all the way up through when we went to high school. So we both fell in love with the game at a very young age because of our uncles who were, instrumental in our development.
What was it about the game, besides obviously the popularity of the sport in the areas around you, what was it about basketball that really grabbed a hold of you and said, this is what I, what did you love about the game at that point?
You know what? I loved everything about it. That was just the whole thing. I loved everything about the game of basketball. I started off playing football. My dad was my first football coach, and I played that all the way up until the eighth grade. And and I was about to go into high school, and I just told him, I said, you know what, Dad? Basketball is something that I really, really love, and I know that I can be really successful at it. And so I really start putting my focus and all my energies, into becoming a better basketball player, and Tommy and I went to the University of Maryland's basketball camp, and guys like Lenny Bias and guys like Johnny Dawkins, Ralph Sampson, they were all there, and my eyes were wide open, and I was bitten by the bug, and I realized then that it was something that I, it was a game that I wanted to play all the time, and it was going to be my ticket to get to college. Being the first person in my family to go to college, my first person in my family to graduate, from college, it was very, very important. So I had to identify a sport, and basketball happened to be that sport. That was my ticket to reaching those goals.
So if you think back to that time, Kevin, compare the system that we have today that when you're going out and you're watching high school kids as a recruiter, when you're seeing those kids play in the system that we have of youth basketball, compare that to how you grew up in the game and maybe talk about in your mind some of the pros and cons of each of the two different systems, how it was when you were growing up and then what it's like now. Talk about some of the positives and negatives of each one of those systems. Because I think there's good and bad to both, and I'm curious to hear what your position is on that.
Yeah, things have changed. They've changed dramatically. When I was growing up, you played AAU basketball, and I won an AAU championship, but all of the guys that was on my team were from the same area. So that was Tommy Amaker and Michael Jackson went to Georgetown, Billy King who went to Duke, Derek Sims went to Virginia, Tyrone Jones went to Oklahoma, but we were all from the Northern Virginia, which is now called the DMV area. It's so vastly different than what I see now when I go out to see grassroots basketball. Kids are from all over the place and representing different representing different areas, but under the same name as one team. But some of the other things that I see that are vastly different is that back then the best players, you all went to the high school that you were zoned to go to. And then it's now it's become more and more players are seeking out schools to go to private schools, prep schools, and, you know, boarding schools. And that's something that, you know, I wasn't accustomed to doing when I was, you know, growing up. But I see that right now as a recruiter, you know, at the collegiate level, you see kids that will, you know, cross the country, and you see more international kids that come to the United States to improve their skills and have a better opportunity to gain, you know, a college scholarship and eventually hopefully reach their goal to play at the highest level they possibly can. So that's primarily some of the things that some of the changes that I see. And lastly, when I grew up in Washington D.C. here, I never thought that, you know, AAU or grassroots basketball would supersede the high school coaches. Because we've always had outstanding high school coach Morgan Wooten at DeMatha, Stu Vetter at Flint Hill. And now you have guys like Mike Jones at DeMatha, who's a fantastic coach, and Steve Turner at Gonzaga. You know, and those guys run outstanding programs. But their players now are on grassroots teams. But back when I was growing up, your high school team was the most important thing, playing summer league and going to camp. And working your high school coach's camp was the norm.
Yeah, it's definitely not the same as it used to be. And I wanted to get your perspective as a college coach. When you go out and you're looking at and evaluating players, how difficult is it to evaluate a kid in the grassroots system, in the AAU system, compared to, let's say, maybe when you first started, you were doing more evaluation within the kids' high school program? Because one of the things that I guess I always have a question about, we've talked to a couple other coaches, both at the high school and the college level, about this. And it seems that if I was a college coach, I'd want to know how a player fit into a system, not necessarily a specific system, but just how they played within a system. And a lot of times in AAU basketball, you're not seeing the player play within a system. It's obviously a much more freewheeling game and open and that kind of thing. And it just seems like as a college coach, I would want to see how that kid performs more with their high school. And I'd still, it seems, would want to put more emphasis on that. But I know that it's shifted because of the evaluation periods and when you have all those kids that are top kids playing against each other as opposed to high school, you might go and see, and maybe there's one Division I player in the game, and, you know, everybody else is just an average high school player. So talk about sort of the compare and contrast when you go out, what you're looking for when you watch an AAU game, what you watch when you watch a high school game. What are you looking for?
Well, I bring a unique perspective because I've been a high school coach for, you know, a number of years at the highest end of high school basketball. So when I was a high school, you know, basketball coach as an assistant and as a head coach, I wanted college coaches to come and to see my players in their more natural environment, which was with our team. But now being on the collegiate side of it, I definitely want to see a kid play with his high school team because I want to see you notice that he's obviously much more comfortable in the system. You know, he's much more comfortable in his natural environment. I want to, you know, so seeing him there is just one perspective. So, and then I also want to see him playing in the AAU or grassroots system as well, because you can evaluate, you know, their athleticism, how they adjust to playing with other very good players. And you also see, you know, if they're capable of being effective in that environment as well as being, you know, coming out of a high school environment where they may be the featured player. So I take those two evaluations, and then I try to use both of those and to make a more accurate evaluation projection of what I think the student athlete can be in our system. So, like I said, you know, being a high school coach, I initially wanted, you know, to have, you know, see him in his natural environment, but now, you know, also being able to see him coach and play in the AAU system is also beneficial as well.
All right, I want to piggyback off that. So obviously there we're talking about evaluating their basketball ability and their athletic ability. And I've got to imagine that is difficult enough in and of itself to be able to figure out, you know, who's going to play and who's capable. And that doesn't get into all the intangibles and character piece of it. So talk about how you evaluate that part of a recruit. Because I think that, you know, some of our audience is parents. Some of our audience may be basketball, high school basketball players who are hoping that they're going to get an opportunity to play college basketball. So if you could give a high school player some advice or just talk about what you're looking for, not so much on the athletic side and the basketball side, but more on the intangible character piece. What are the things that you're looking for that are important? How do you make those evaluations of the type of kid that you want to bring into your program?
The intangibles are very important, especially, you know, from to me, and they always have been, you know, because I truly believe that the intangibles are the separators. So what I like to do is I like to get to a venue as early as I possibly can, whether it be, you know, if I'm going to see a kid in his high school, you know, if they work out right after school, I like to get there, you know, before the school day ends, you know, and see him come across campus into the gym and see how he interacts with, you know, other students as he's coming into the gym and how he prepares himself to get ready to work out. If it's an AAU event, I will get there early and just to see how he, you know, prepares himself to get ready to play. You know, is he sitting there just waiting till the game ends and then he's going to start putting on his shoes and putting on his gear? Or is he already, you know, getting his gear together and starting a little stretching routine so as soon as that horn sounds, he's ready to take the floor and actively warm up? So those are the type of things. And then also see him interact, you know, with his teammates, with his coaches. Those things are vitally important, you know, to me. You know, the intangibles of being a good teammate, you know, when you see a kid in his natural setting and he's one of the best players or if not the best player, he acts a certain way. You know, most times other people defer to him. But when you see him in an environment where he's on an all-star team or on a very good AAU grassroots program, you know, he's one of many talented players. So you see him acting a certain way there. And sometimes the personality is the same. You know, if you're an alpha dog or alpha male in your high school team, and, you know, some of those guys just come right over and just assume that same personality with their AAU team. And that's important to see, too. The intangibles are vitally important, you know, leadership and, you know, the ability to lead, you know, and how do they lead? And then on another team, they may have to take a role of being a follower. Well, you know, are they a good follower, you know, or are they a guy that just kind of waits for their turn to speak or lead and they actively, you know, aren't, you know, they're what I call a bad follower. So all those intangible things that you try to look at, I try to look at and I try to take you know, great notes on and see if when they're not in the game, are they not in the game physically, you know, or I mean, when they're sitting on the bench, are they actively cheering for their teammates and are they excited when the player who's playing in their position has success? All those things are important and observable.
Right. So those are things that you can see. And I think that probably does paint a very good picture. How much do you go and talk to their high school coach, a principal, a teacher, somebody else from their background, their AAU coach? How much stock do you put into those kinds of conversations and interviews that you may have with those people to find out? And at what point in the process do you engage those people? Do you get it where you got to be fairly serious about a guy before you get to that point? Or is that a conversation you're having as you're starting the process? Where does that fall in your process of recruiting?
Those conversations are important. And I talk to everybody. Again, I try to get there early. You know, I will purposely go over and see the secretary. I'll talk to the guidance counselor. I'll go to the cafeteria and talk to the people in the lunch line. Again, my perspective, you know, I was a high school coach. You know, and so my players, I would make sure that they it was important that they addressed people, you know, on campus in a polite, respectful manner, because I never, you know, wanted them to be caught off guard when a college coach came on campus and did, what I do now, and asked the lady in the lunch line, like, hey, how is, Randolph Childress? Oh, he's terrible. He's always asking for more food. He doesn't like our food here. And those things are important because the lady in the lunch line, you know, is somebody's mom, you know, somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, and they're people too. So like I said, so I try to talk to as many people as possible. I call it their circle of influence. So who are the circle of influence? Who are the people in the student athlete's life that he listens to, you know, that, you know, he will, you know, take information from, who touches his life. So I try to identify who's the circle of influence and who in that circle of influence has the kid's ear the most. And I'll share one story with you. When I was at Bishop McNamara High School, Taiwan Lawson was a rising freshman. And Taiwan Lawson was heavily recruited out of middle school to come play in the WCAC. And I was fortunate enough to get him to come to play at Bishop McNamara. But everyone thought that in his circle of influence, everyone thought that his mom and his dad were and his trainer were the most important people. But lo and behold, the most important person, you know, that really had Taiwan's ear was the janitor that opened the gym every morning that let him shoot. And so once my assistant coach, Antoine Jackson, who is now at Virginia Tech, once we figured that out, we spent all our time connecting with the janitor to get closer to Taiwan. So you got to figure out who in the circle of influence has the most influence.
Absolutely. So how much easier, and easy is a relative term, but how much easier, how much better are you at that process today than you were, let's say, when you had your first college assistant coaching job? How much are you able to kind of cut through the noise and figure stuff out faster? And obviously the process is imperfect and you're never going to bat 100%, but just the process of going through that, how much better are you at it today than when you first started?
Well, with social media, you know, and the generation these kids are, this generation, they put everything that they do and say out on social media. So,
true.
You know, and I'm fortunate enough to have kids, you know, that are a little bit older than them. So anything that I don't understand social media wise, I can ask my kids and then they can, you know, decipher for me the code, the lingo, and the knowledge. And I gain knowledge, you know, and insight into that particular kid, you know, on the things that they post on social media, you know. And so then if it's positive, then I know that when I have my opportunity to talk to them, I can talk about those things, you know. And if it's a negative thing and if it's a red flag, you know, then that's something else that I have to, you know, weigh in an hour and take back to Coach Cox as a decision maker and make sure he's aware of. So it's a lot easier now because of social media. You know, before social media, yeah, you had to depend on the conversations and the relationship that you had built around him, you know, whether it's high school coach, whether, like I said, back to his circle of influence. So it's a lot easier now. And I think I'm a lot better now than I was before.
Okay, so the social media piece, are you finding now that the kids are at least somewhat more conscious about what they're posting on social media as opposed to like 5 years ago? Or do you think that kids are still going to be kids and make mistakes and put things on social media? Because I personally think that the kids are at least getting at least more up with it and realizing that they shouldn't post things on social media that shouldn't go there. Do you find that or no?
I'm going to say no to that question. With an asterisk on, I hope that they will learn, because it's something that we at, you know, at the collegiate level, certainly at the University of Rhode Island, we have to spend a lot of time on educating them on, you know, social media and how to effectively use it to build your brand, for lack of a better term. But, you know, having them to understand the power, you know, and the magnitude of social media, while they put things on there to receive, you know, the instant gratification of a like, you know, well, what happens when you play a bad game and that same person that just 2 minutes ago, you know, or, you know, a while ago was just, you know, singing your praises and liking what everything you put on there. And then you go 0-5 and we end up losing a game and now they're killing you. Can you handle that? You know,
right.
Because it's, you know, it's so impersonal because, you know, the praise or the adulation comes from a person that you may not even know. And then the, you know, the, the opposite of that when a person is, you know, the negative is you know, making negative and disparaging comments about you, you're surprised because you're like, this person just was, you know, singing my praises, and now he's just killing me. So, you know, I would say no, with the hopes that they would learn more and be more selective as to what they put on there, you know. But it is the age. Like when I was growing up, whatever we did in Falls Church, Virginia, in our neighborhood, stayed in our neighborhood until you told someone outside your neighborhood. But whatever these kids are doing in their neighborhoods today, they don't even have to tell anybody. They're posted. So I'm finding out, you know, what they, you know, thought was a funny prank or, you know, right, things that they're doing, that I'm finding out instantaneously. You know, like I said before, you know, if we did something we thought was funny and or was a prank, you know, it kind of stayed in our neighborhood until you told someone else in another neighborhood.
Yeah, I can't even imagine going through and thinking back to when I played. And I graduated from college in 92, so mm-hmm. I played from 88 to 92. So we're in the same age bracket here. And I can't even imagine having had social media available and just going through my college experience and just the pressures, maybe the wrong word, but just, you know, the scrutiny that you felt you were under and just the, you know, how hard you had to work and all this stuff. And then to have where you could pick up your phone after the game and have all these messages of, you know, positive or negative, and just having people weighing in on your performance. And, you know, basically after a game, like I had to deal with maybe, you know, one reporter asking me questions if I had a bad game, and then,
right,
you know, come back and let alone have, you know, maybe one friend said, oh, you only had 4 points.
Mike's saying he would have created burner accounts like Durant. Yeah, and,
I don't know if I'd have gone that far, but it's like, I can't imagine being a kid today and being under the same level of scrutiny that you or I were under when we played, and then adding this whole other layer, like you just described, I'm not sure I'd be very happy under that system. I'm glad I got out before I was under the social media spotlight.
Yeah, you know what? What's interesting is that kids are being exposed to so much so quickly and so earlier. You know, just before we got on air, I was watching the Little League World Series, you know, and those kids are, you know, some of those kids are 12, 13 years of age, and they're doing interviews.
Right.
And they've never taken a public speaking class, you know, but they're experiencing things at such a young age. They're on ESPN and the like. And so we're asking them to grow up a lot faster and a lot quicker and a lot sooner than maybe some of them are actually able to mature enough to handle, you know.
For sure.
And that's back to your point, you know, when you have a microphone, you know, thrust into your face after a game, you know, that's one thing. But when you have, you know, social media and everybody around the world can, you know, find out, you know, what goes on, and it's more instantaneous. It's a lot more powerful and carries a whole lot more weight.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many more people that can weigh in. And I think that now you can never, and this goes for not just athletes, but for kids in general, I think you can never get away from your peers and that judgment eye that's out there. And I think that's got to be tough on kids, because no matter where I go, you know, it used to be if I had a tough day at school or I had a bad game, you could go home and go in your house and go in your room or go out on your driveway and shoot baskets and kind of get away from everything. And now, because we carry that phone in our pocket everywhere we go, those messages are popping up and kids are seeing them. And that to me has got to be, it's got to be tough. And I know they grow up with it, so they don't know differently. So for us who didn't grow up in that era, you know, we see what it was like before. I just think it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of things for kids to handle. And, you know, it just speaks to the need again for quality adults in their life, whether yes. those adults are parents or coaches or teachers or whoever is going to end up looking out for kids. You know, we all need to make sure that we're advocating for them, because I think growing up now is tougher than it's ever been, simply because of, again, all that scrutiny and just the fact that it's there 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week.
I could not agree with you more.
All right. I want to go backwards to when you were getting recruited, and talk a little bit about when you knew or when you thought that you might have the opportunity to play college basketball, and then what your recruitment was like, what your decision-making process was, what you went through, and just kind of give us that perspective so we get an idea of what happened to you while you were on the college basketball recruiting trail.
Right. Well, you know, I was really fortunate. I had, you know, coaches that really poured into my life, and I also had, you know, uncles who had talent but didn't have the opportunity, and they made sure that I did have the opportunity. And one, my AAU coach in particular, Reginald Kitchen, came down from Philadelphia, and he had a huge impact on us. When I say us, I mean Tommy and everyone. You know, so he was the one who kept telling us that we could play, we could play Division I basketball, and so we start dreaming about it, and we start thinking about it, and we start practicing towards it, you know, and we start chasing that dream, you know, back in the ninth grade, and even maybe before that, and so that's when I committed, you know, to basketball. You know, to reaching the goal of getting to college and having it paid for, because it would have been very difficult for my family to send me to college. And so I started off at a public school called Falls Church High School, and then I transferred to Flint Hill to play for Stu Vetter, who's a Hall of Fame coach in that area. And he had built a solid program and was starting to put players into the collegiate level. And I was a high school senior when USA Today started putting out the Super 25, and we were 25-5, and we had a really good team. And so I started getting recruited. Back then, when you got the form letter, you kind of ran
around. Absolutely, I remember those days. Yeah,
you kind of ran around your neighborhood, and you showed everybody, and you just kept it, and you just read it over and over again. You know, and not realizing it was an actual form letter, and you filled out the questionnaire and you sent it back in, and you know, then you started receiving the letters in the mail, and before you realize it, you started to go to the guidance office and started researching the universities, and so, you know, Coach Vetter, you know, started to play a big role in my life in my junior year, and then we started playing, and college coaches would come to our practice, and they would come, you know, to our summer league games and in our regular season games. And then guys were getting offered scholarships. My senior year, I got an offer to scholarship and accepted one to James Madison University. My backcourt mate, John Sickles, went to Hofstra. David Atkins, who's the player development coach for the Washington Wizards right now, went to Old Dominion University. Gerald Jackson went to Minnesota, and Derek Sims went to Virginia. So we had some talented players, and you know, the recruiting process was a lot different. You know, coaches came in and you sat down and you connected with them, but they didn't blow your phone up or anything like that. Everything went through Coach Vetter, and he kind of, you know, ran interference, for lack of a better term.
Right. Yeah. No. Understand.
And we got it down to schools that we were most interested in, and we went and took visits. And then for me, I went to James Madison, and literally, it sounds almost poetic, but I went to the Quad and walked around, and I really realized that I could be very successful there.
What's your best memory from your time there? If somebody asked you, hey, what was the best time of those years when you were at James Madison? What's your answer there?
We don't have enough time for that answer. I absolutely love, still to this day, I absolutely love that university. And any person that I talk to and I find out they went to James Madison, I said, you loved it, didn't it? And their answer is always the same thing. It was yes. You know, the time that I was there, just think about this. Our football team had Gary Clark, Charles Haley, Scott Norwood. Three guys that played in the Super Bowl, two guys who won multiple Super Bowl, well, one Super Bowl, one guy who was just a field goal, you know, away from winning the Super Bowl. So it was an absolute, you know, great time to be a student athlete at James Madison University. Again, it fit me perfectly. The distance was 2 hours away from home, so it was far enough from home to be independent, but yet close enough to be home to be near my family. The people there are incredibly nice. My host mom is, you know, still lives in, you know, in Harrisonburg, and she's, you know, we stay in contact to this day. Like I said, I loved it. It was just a great place for me. I made some lasting friends, got a great education. So my time there was fantastic.
There's a testament to finding the right fit, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Head Start Basketball's cutthroat game building program debuts on Tuesday nights in September. Players in grades 5 through 10, both boys and girls, you won't want to miss this one. Registration is open now at www.headstartbasketball.com.
There's a lot of challenges in trying to find the right place, and we can see that by the number of kids that, you know, transfer every year. And as you mentioned, that starts to go down even into the high school ranks, where, you know, you knew that, you know, you kind of had an idea of who you were going to play with and what you want to do and when you were playing. And then now we have kids who, you know, who knows what high school they're going to go to this year or next year. And they're always chasing something. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side. And it pays if you're a kid, and obviously on the coaching side of it, to do your due diligence to make sure that wherever you go, that it's the right fit. And I think that's one of the big challenges that we have in the game of basketball today, is making sure that parents and players are educated about not just the basketball side of it, but of finding a complete fit in the university as well, and with the coaching staff and professors and just people in general on the campus. And I think it, you know, it speaks highly of what you were able to do, that you found that right place. And I'm sure you would agree that that has now paid dividends way beyond any value that, you know, anything that it would have cost you or anything. It's invaluable what it's done in your life. And I think when you find the right fit, that's what happens. And I feel the same way. I ended up in the right place for me, and I could have gone to some other places where it probably wouldn't have ended up being the right fit, and I wouldn't have had the experience that I was able to have. And so if you can find that right fit, you're going to end up with better outcomes for sure. And it sounds like that's what happened with you.
Yeah, and that's the most important thing, is finding the right fit. And again, sometimes the circle of influence doesn't allow for kids to, you know, understand what that means.
Right.
You know, they don't, they want, again, instant gratification, instant success. And sometimes you have to go through things to appreciate, you know, them even more. You know, there is such a word called gratitude. And so, you know, when you go through some things and then you come out on the other side, you are much more grateful for having had gone through them. You know, so when you pick a school and you find it's the right fit, that it makes it so much easier. But sometimes kids, you know, in today's game, they're not even allowed to. The kid is there at the university, and they recognize what's going on, and they know they're probably not holding up their end of the bargain at that particular point. But they also see that that there is the potential to, in within a, maybe the end of the season, or at the, maybe next year, that their opportunity will come. They're not even given those opportunities. Their circle of influence, maybe one, two people in that circle, is telling them, "You got to get out of here. You got to get out of here.
Yeah.
We got to go someplace else."
Right.
You know. And then now the kid is so confused, because this person is a person that they trust. And now they're confused between, okay, this person who I trust and oftentimes has the same last name as me, and now I got to go against them and go trust my new coach. Yeah, and it's difficult, you know.
It's tough.
And that's what you have coupled with the fact that the NCAA continues to make it easier for these kids to transfer. That's why they don't stick around.
Besides obviously the ease of transfer, what else do you attribute just that situation that you described? You think that it's the instant gratification, social media age, where it's just, if it doesn't happen right away, then I'm not willing to put my time in? Because we've talked to a lot of coaches on the show that have similar stories, where, you know, they ended up going to a school and maybe they didn't play a lot their first year, maybe they didn't play a lot their second year,
right,
and they put their time in, and eventually they got their opportunity. They didn't just run to the next place. And I think it's tough. It's tough to tell a kid who, you know, was a star in high school, has been being told from the time they're 12, 13, 14 years old, that hey, you're going to be this, you have a chance to do that. And all of a sudden, they get to a college program and everybody's as good as them. Everybody's as talented as them. They got to work maybe harder than they ever thought they were going to have to work. And now suddenly they're faced with the decision of, hey, am I going to stick it out and really push myself and grow and try to get better? Or do I just go out the door and try to find somewhere else to go? And it's just, again, it speaks to what we mentioned a few minutes ago, that to have the right people in that circle of influence, as you describe, to be able to give the kind of advice that's going to end up having the best long-term effect for the kid. And I think that's something that a lot of times parents, players don't always recognize what the long-term benefit is of whatever their situation may be. And instead, they're focused on just that here and now. And I think about my own situation. I went from, you know, being a high school best player on my team to going to Kent State, and I played as a freshman very little, maybe 5 minutes a game. And I had another teammate who was a very, very good player. He played maybe a little less than me, but he, if he would have stuck around, he probably would have been a 2-year starter there and been really, really good. And instead, he ended up going to a smaller school. He had a great career there, but I look at it and say, man, if he would have stuck around, he could have had a great experience, you know, where we were. And it's just, it's interesting because I think kids don't always make that long-term decision. Instead, they're looking at that short-term. And as you said, people in their life sometimes aren't letting them make the choice that they might have made if they were given their own, you know, given their own circumstance.
Again, you're absolutely right. I mean, these are things that you have to educate kids through. You know, like you said, the short-term, you know, vision versus the long-term vision. You know, and then you also have to educate them in life. These are life lessons. You know, in life, you're going to struggle. It's inevitable. You are going to struggle at some point. And then what are you going to do when you're faced with some level of adversity? You know, and how are you going to respond to that? No, these are life lessons. And through the game, and this is what the sport teaches you. This is what sports teaches you. And this is the reason why I got into coaching, is because I love using, you know, the game of basketball to teach life lessons and try to prepare my student athletes in every way possible and take a holistic approach to development, not just athletic development, but character development, academic development, you know, and using these life lessons to, again, prepare them for what we all know is, you know, the game of life, you know. And so, when we don't, and we lose sight and we lose our perspective, that's when we start making decisions based on what's most comfortable at that particular moment, or what's, you know, this is uncomfortable, let me get out of this situation. This is not working, this is not fun, and you hear that often. So let me leave this particular situation, because I think that if I go someplace else, you know, it's better. And like you said, you know, the proverbial grass is greener on the other side. But my, I'll quote my dad, who, you know, spoke in more parables than Jesus himself sometimes. he would always say, yeah, Kevin, you think the grass is greener on the other side? Don't forget they have something called AstroTurf. Isn't that fake grass? And I would be like, yes, sir, it is.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And it's true. I mean, I think that we all have a tendency to chase what's easy, what's convenient, what benefits us in the short term. And as a society, I think that's one of the issues that we face, is just we have to be able to look at the long term, and we have to be able to delay that gratification. And that's hard. It's hard when everybody around you is, you know, telling you this and is in your ear and you're seeing it on your phone. And it just, you know, you get all these messages that are saying, hey, you shouldn't be having to wait for what's rightfully yours. And instead, you know, I think long term, we know that if you can help a kid to be able to learn to fight through that adversity, like you described, you're going to end up with better results in the long term. So this is a good point too, and you just talked about it here, that you wanted to be able to use the game of basketball as a vehicle to teach life lessons and to have an impact on kids. At what point in your life did you know that you wanted to coach? Was that something that you knew even while you were playing? You're like, when I'm done, I know I want to coach. Or was that something that hit you or came to you as your playing career was winding down, and now you're like, oh, I want to stay in the game. How can I go about staying in the game? So when did you know you wanted to coach?
I knew I wanted to coach my freshman year in high school when I was a captain, and I wanted to be captain of my freshman team so badly, and I was fortunate enough to be named, you know, captain, you know, of the team, you know. So I knew, you know, back then that I wanted to be the leader, you know, of the team, you know, and have that position of power, which was brought about, you know, by being named the captain. And then I just really, again, just had good coaches prior to that poured into my life, and they were good role models. They taught the game the right way. They taught the principles, you know, how to play. They taught about being a good teammate. And I just kind of just remembered those things. So every team that I went, I was on, I wanted to be the captain of the team, you know, and then be in that leadership position. And then when I got to college, I would come back home every summer, and I would, you know, coach my high school team in summer league, which was really, really, really competitive. But Coach Vedder saw in me the desire to become a coach, and he would let me design the practice plan, and then he would correct it and make some, you know, some adjustments to it, and then I would have to implement it and teach it to our high school team, and then I would have to, you know, coach a games, you know, over the weekend, and then I would drive back to James Madison, you know, on Sunday, and be ready for class, you know, on Monday. But I was also bitten by the bug, very fortunate, very lucky, because when I was coming back to Flint Hill, I was coaching guys like Dennis Scott. So I looked around and I was like, yeah, this play works every
day. Right. Yeah, exactly. That's pretty easy. That's pretty easy to design a play. Yeah, that works. Yeah, you might have had an advantage over your average high school coach in that.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but.
Yeah, I knew at an early age that I wanted to be a coach.
Yeah, it's very cool. I mean, I think that, you know, just from the brief time that we've gotten to know each other here and just hearing you talk, I mean, you can feel, A, the passion that you have for coaching, and then, B, you can feel the fact that you want to have an impact, not just on kids on the basketball floor, but be able to give them something more than that, and to be able to give them and share those life lessons and really help them to grow. And I think this is a good point, even though we're going to jump maybe off our chronological timeline, but I think it's a good point for you to talk a little bit about your living trophies and what that means to you and what that is, because that's a term that before Alan Stein was nice enough to connect us, that I had never heard that term, but I love it. And I want you to explain a little bit about what that is, what it means to you, and then maybe talk about one or two of the quote living trophies that you've been able to have an impact on, and what those people are doing today.
Absolutely. You know, the game of basketball has, you know, been unbelievable to me. You know, it's taken a young man from Falls Church, Virginia, you know, around the world, actually, you know, and I've, you know, been able to go to college and have a, you know, great experience and get a college education, and now making a, you know, a living, you know, from the game of basketball. So when I decided I wanted to get into coaching, the first thing I said is I wanted to use the game of basketball to teach life lessons and to impact as many lives as I possibly can through the game of basketball. And so I started to develop my philosophies, you know, and they were not just, you know, basketball philosophies of, you know, offense and defense, but it was how I was going to build, you know, my program and what my program was going to be. So my vision statement, and I had to come up with a vision statement and a value statement and a mission statement. And all those things grounded me, and it kept pointing me back to impacting lives. And so the more that I, you know, the more I got involved with coaching, and the more I started to enjoy coaching, and I took a holistic approach, you know, to development. And player development and personal development and academic development and social development and emotional development. And all those things were, you know, very important to me. So I'm a lifelong learner. So I read a lot. You know, I study, you know, study a game a lot. I study people a lot. You know, I study, you know, leaderships a lot and all those things. And I'm very, very spiritual. My faith is important to me. So I try to, you know, bring all that together into my coaching. And one of the things that really stuck out to me was that throughout all my successes that I've had, you know, in winning trophies here and there and gold medals, and those trophies end up, you know, they're stationary, and we win trophies and we put them in a trophy case. And then, you know, 10 years later, we'll bring that team back and the team will sit there and take a picture, but we'll pull that trophy out of the trophy case, but it has 10 years of dust on that trophy.
Yep.
But when you take the opportunity, and I look at myself as a coach, that's a ladle. And as a ladle, you have the opportunity to put water into the bucket, or you have the opportunity to take water away out of the bucket. And so I came up with the term living trophies because I want to pour into the student athletes, whomever it may be, that I coach. I want to pour into their lives. I want to hear what their dreams are. I want to help them try to reach their dreams.
So can you talk a little bit about what that looks like on a daily basis as a coach at the various levels you've been at? So let's start with high school. When you're a high school coach and you're pouring into your kids on a day-to-day basis,
yeah.
What does that look like on the practice floor? What does that look like in school? What does that look like outside of their school day? Just give us some things that you do on a daily basis to make sure that your coaching is having an impact on more than just their jump shot.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. Cameron Dollar, Cameron played for me 2 years ago. I was at he was a junior at Harker Prep, and he was a senior at St. John's Cross McCall. So one way that Cam and I really connected was he was growing into his faith, and so every Sunday I would take him to church with me. And we lived an hour away from where the church was. But my grandmother told me a long time ago, no place is too far, because that's where you want to be, and especially if you're being spiritually fed. And so Cameron would go there every Sunday. And then I remember vividly, we played a school, and it was in Southern Virginia, and we got back like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I told Cam, I said, I'm not sure I'm going to go to church on tomorrow. And he was like, Coach, please go to church. Please go to church. I said, Cam, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. I said, but call me in the morning, you know. And so service started at 8 o'clock, and like I said, church was an hour away. So Cameron calls me at 6, and I said, okay, I'm gonna go like that. And I said, we can go. So I said, I'll pick you up usually at the usual place. So I picked him up, and lo and behold, that was the day that he gave his life to Christ. So you kind of meet the kids where they are. Another story is like with Randolph Childress. You know, Randolph was a junior at Flint Hill, played on a very good team with George Lynch and Aaron Bain. And Randolph had received, a college scholarship offer from several schools at the mid-major level. And he kept telling me that he was a high major player. And I said, well, what are you going to do about that? And he said, you tell me what I need to do to become a high major player, and I'm going to do it. I said, well, okay, you need to meet me every day before school. And you need to meet me at lunch, and then we need to meet, and we need to stay after the practice. And Randolph lived an hour and a half away from school, and he had to catch a bus to the metro system, a train, and then I would pick him up at the train station, and we would work out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and then he would come at lunchtime, and lunch was like 45 minutes, and he would, shoot for like half hour, and then he would get dressed really fast and go on to class. And then we would stay after practice. And he was fortunate enough to go to Wake Forest and still holds the record in the ACC tournament. But I try to meet them where they are, and I just try to stay connected and try to listen to them as much as I can. And I still do that today. I try to listen to the kids and what they want to do. And then I try to meet them where they are. When I say meet them where they are, sometimes that's a physical meeting them where they are, but also sometimes it's an emotional meet them where they are from a maturity standpoint. And then sometimes it's a spiritual, meet them on a spiritual level. And so I just try to connect with them in any way, shape, or form as I can. And I do a lot of stuff with books. I do a lot of stuff with motivational quotes. And I hand that stuff out very freely. And one life lesson that I learned is that, you have three types of people. You have the person that looks at it and never is going to read it. You have the person that looks at it and reads part of it. And then you have that other person that looks at it and reads it and totally understands it. And so early in my career, I used to get frustrated But now, subsequently now, later in my career, I realized that, you know what, I just got to keep doing what I do, and hopefully and eventually they all get it.
Right. That's so true. I think that's one of the things that sometimes I know during my day job and Jason's day job as teachers and also as coaches, you sometimes get frustrated that you're not getting through to everybody or it doesn't feel like you're having the kind of impact that you want to have. But what you just said is you keep plugging away at it. You keep providing those opportunities. You keep providing that kind of nourishment to someone. And the hope is that eventually, maybe it happens a year from now, maybe it happens 5 years from now, maybe it happens 10 years from now, that they remember something that you said that has some kind of positive impact on their life. And I think that really is what it's all about. And what I hear you saying is, as I listen to those stories that you just told, what I pulled out of that is the way that you are connecting with those players is, A, you're pouring time into them. So you're giving of your time to people. And there's nothing more valuable that you can give to somebody than your time. And then as a result of you giving your time, you're then forging and building relationships with those players in a way that's far more meaningful than just the X's and O's on the basketball court. And there's no way that Randolph Childress and Cameron Dollar, after having experienced that with you, there's no way that they could look at that and say, this guy isn't there for me. This guy isn't doing everything he can to make me be at my very, very best. And I think that is something that is invaluable to a kid. And when you have adults in your life that do that for you, it just makes all the difference in where people end up, regardless of where they started. When they have strong people pouring into them, it gives them a greater opportunity for success without question.
Can I add to both of those stories?
Absolutely.
And here to back to your point. Well, first, I want to make one point before I go to make another point. You both are educators. You teach and you coach, but you're educators, and that's what we do best. We use our platform. You know, my wife is an accomplished educator, and she has taught me that she's like, what you do and what I do, you know, as a teacher and as a coach, you're an educator. So I applaud you both for what you do. You're an educator. You're not a teacher. You're not a coach. You're an educator. You're impacting lives, and that's the most important thing. But the point I want to make about what you said, the giving of your time is absolutely the most important thing. That is the commodity that we all can give and we can share. To add to those stories, when Randolph Childress set the record in the ACC tournament, I was in the arena, and I went to the tournament. And as like a father, I couldn't sit in my seat because he was making every shot. And I was thinking to myself, like, he's going to miss at some point. And lo and behold, after the tournament was over, he looks up in the stands and he points straight to me. His mom is like, you know, on my left hand side, and he points right to me and he points right to himself. And he's like, we did this. And then later when we got together, he said, every morning you told me that I could do this. And I believed you. And we did this. And with Cameron Dollar, same way, when he won a national championship, he calls me right after the game and he said, coach, we won a national championship. And I said, yeah, your team did. He said, coach, you and me won this national championship.
That's awesome. I mean, those are the moments that I think anybody who is in education, anybody who is a coach, mm-hmm. that those are the most meaningful things that can ever happen, that somebody attributes their success to the relationship and to the things that you've been able to do for them. And even though I'm sure you would be the same way as I would or Jason would, that you would deflect that credit back to the individual.
Absolutely.
But the fact of the matter is that those individuals that we were able to impact and help have a feeling and have an affinity for what you or I or Jason were able to do for them. And as a result, we've made that kind of positive impact on the people that we're able to touch. And I think that really is, you know, it's interesting because that's, I think, sort of what we wanted to do with this podcast when we started, was how can we take and give back and give a platform to people to be able to have an impact, whether it's on coaches, whether it's on parents of basketball players, whether it's on the players themselves. Can we provide a platform that's going to have an impact beyond what we might be able to do personally for somebody? And that's something that's changed for me. And this will kind of get into my next question for you, is what's changed for me as a coach is I know that I don't know that I came to the realization that you came to quite as early in my career in terms of using the game of basketball to teach life lessons. I think early in my career, I was more focused on the basketball piece of it than I was on the relationships and on the life lessons and that kind of thing. And I've come to that a little bit later in life. And so that's one of the ways that I've evolved as a coach. So my question to you is, how have you evolved as a coach, and what have you gotten better at since you first started? If you think back to your early days of coaching compared to where you are now, what are you better at today than you were when you first started?
That's a great question. I pride myself on being a lifelong learner. I study the game of basketball. You know, I'm an avid reader. I'm trying to stay current, but trying to stay in the forefront of things.
What are you reading right now?
Well, I just finished reading a great book called Dear Martin, and it's unrelated. It's not a sports related book at all. It's more of a social book, but it's called Dear Martin by Nick Stone, and it's a young lady out of Atlanta, but it's talking about an African-American young man who is fighting two worlds because he has to leave his neighborhood where he is chastised for leaving the neighborhood because he's bright enough to get selected to go to an all-white private school, and then he doesn't fit in that world either.
Right.
So he looks at the teachings of Martin Luther King, and he starts to write letters and tries to learn from, you know, Martin Luther King's lessons, and he gets caught up in the two worlds and how they collide. So it was a fantastic book. So that was my most recent book.
Got it. Interesting.
So, yeah. Back to your question of how have I evolved and changed, I think I'm way more effective now as a leader and a communicator than I was before. I'm certainly, you know, more open to, you know, being more educated and learning the two things, and it's really helped me and been beneficial, is that understanding people, their personalities, you know, which one I can, you know, put my arm around, which one I can, you know, kick in the butt, if I can say that.
yep, absolutely. We know what you mean.
Yeah, and then also understanding people's learning styles. How do they learn best? When I was the head coach at Montford Academy, it was an international boarding school. So any given year, I could, you know, have six or seven kids from, you know, various countries, and oftentimes I could have a starting lineup with, you know, three kids on the floor speaking three different languages, you know, and so my wife was beneficial, you know, in helping me grow in this area, to understand that you have to become a more effective communicator, and secondly, you have to understand people's personalities, and then third, if you really want to reach them, is to understand that, you know, kids don't all learn the same way. So if you can, you know, understand that and teach to those points of how they different learn, which one of them, you know, which one set of kids are kinesthetic learners, which one are visual learners, which ones are, you know, read-write learners, which ones are auditory learners, you know, and if you can adjust your coaching style accordingly without changing, you know, totally, and have the message be communicated effectively, then you're more likely to have sustainable success.
How long does it take you to sort of get to know the kids well enough to be able to make those kinds of judgments, to be able to help you to better communicate with them? As a, let's say right now in your current job, how long do you have to get to know those kids before you really can sort of zero in on what makes them tick?
The questions that you ask during the recruiting process, you know, and then you, again, you start to identify their circle of influence, and you talk to them and you get to know them. And then, and you, again, back to the point of watching their social media. And one thing that I try to learn as a recruiter is, and I will ask, you know, hey, how do you like for me to communicate with you? Oh, coach, you can text message me. Oh, coach, I love when you call me. Okay, coach, you know, call me early, you know, in the morning. Coach, I stay up late at night. You know, coach, you can hit me on, you know, Instagram. Some guys just like, you know, the visual. You know, Jeff Dowden is great. I mean, all I have to do is send a picture of a lion to Jeff Dowden.
And he knows what that means, right? He knows what it means.
He knows exactly what it means. And so I do, though. I ask those questions, like, how do you want me to communicate with you? Because, you know, this generation, they don't like talking, you know. And they certainly, you know, I'm 55 years old, and I got kids their age, so sometimes they don't want to talk, you know, but they will through text messages, you know, they'll talk more freely, you know, with that or emojis or any kind of way. you kind of reach out and try to reach them, you know, sometimes, you know, is the most effectively where they are. So,
all right, let's talk about your high school coaching days and go into sort of advice that you might have for high school coaches. Somebody who's new, who's just getting into the profession, what are some things that you would recommend based on your experience that a brand new high school coach should do in order to start to build the type of program where they have a winning culture? And obviously, we're not talking here X's and O's. We're talking more about the intangible side mm-hmm. of what it takes to build a program. So what are some things that you think, I'm a 24-year-old, I'm going to get my first head coaching job at the high school level. What are some things that I should know heading in that can make my job easier and allow me to build the type of program that I want to build if I want to be successful long term?
Well, I would say this. First and foremost, you have to do the introspection. You have to look at yourself and you have to decide what is my vision for my program. Okay, what's the vision for the program? What is the mission, you know, of the program? And then what are my values? You know, what are the values of this program? And then what are my non-negotiables? What am I willing to negotiate? What am I not willing to negotiate? So you have to look at yourself and you have to understand yourself and to make sure that then you start to build the program in that image of who you are, what you stand for, what we're going to accomplish, how we're going to accomplish it. And these are the things that I will allow, and these are the things I won't allow. And so the clearer that picture is, and the understanding of the importance of longevity, because some of these guys that, you know, come into this thinking like, hey, this is going to be easy. I want to be in high school and I want to get up to the college level as quick as I possibly can. Okay. Well, then guess what? Oftentimes those guys take, you know, shortcuts and or cut corners. But if longevity is important, you know, to you, then you're going to take those incremental steps to build the program the right way and set a solid foundation so that when you are successful, then you'll have sustainable success because you'll have a foundation that is built on something that's rock solid. So I think you got to do all of those type of things first. You know, the X and O part, you know, is relatively easy, you know, because, you know, you have to have something that is built on a foundation that is going to be rock solid, that's going to last. So I would recommend a coach to do that. I would also recommend a coach to look and see if it's possible to build the program that you want to build at that particular school. You know, meaning is the administration committed? Are they committed to supporting you and doing the things that and believing the things that and when they believe in it, then they'll start to buy into the things that you stand for and the type of program that you're going to build for that particular school and that particular school's community. If the administration is on board, then you're more likely to have more success.
I love that answer. I think it's so true. I've seen it firsthand in different places, both in a positive and negative way, where you have a great administration that understands the goals and the dreams and the vision of a particular program and are supportive of that dream, and then things go really well. And conversely, if you have a non-supportive administration, things can go south in a hurry. When you make decisions that then are not supported above you. And I think that's one of the challenges that high school coaches face today, is that administrations or people above them, if you don't have that kind of support, it becomes very difficult in today's climate to make the types of decisions that you need to make in terms of putting the program over the individual. And if you're not going to be supported by people around you, it gets very, very tough. I want to pull out two questions from what you said. One is, and you've mentioned it twice now, so I want to just make sure we hit on this point. You talked about a coach writing down their vision, their mission statement, their philosophy, thinking about who they are. How important in your mind is it that they write that down as opposed to have it just in their head? Because I think anybody who becomes a coach, you have these ideas of, here's what I want to do with my program, here's kind of what I believe in. But tell me why you think it's so important for them to put it down on paper.
Back to the point of how people learn, you know, I think it's really important, you know, to have it, you know, not only in your mind and in you're able to articulate it, but then also it has to be visual, you know, so people when you're not around, then they can see it, you know, if it's posted someplace and then they can look at it. And then also you want to make sure that you are getting people to believe in what you're talking about, you know. And so writing it down, you know, kind of reinforces, like, this is real, you know, this is not just lip service. This is real. This is what I stand for here now. Okay. I mean, I want to make sure you understand, you know, this is the vision. Okay. And this is the mission and this is the value, you know, and not only are they words, but these words are going to come to life in our actions. But I want you to understand that this is not me just paying lip service and coming up with some flowery words. This is what this is going to happen. This is what's going to be the program. And this is how we're going to do it. This is why we're doing what we're doing. Okay. And you're either going to have to, you know, buy in or get bought out. Which one?
So how do you engage the greater school community? And let's say I'm a public high school coach, how do I engage my greater community in my program? If I'm just coming into a new school, a new situation, and I want to get people excited and fired up about what it is that I'm going to do. So now I have my vision statement written out. I have my philosophies there. And now I want to go out and I want to sell that to the community to start getting people on board and making sure that they're going to be supportive. Who and how do I go about doing that? Who do I talk to? How do I talk to them? What am I trying to do when I go out and sell my program in the community? What are some things that maybe you've done in the past or that you've seen done successfully by other coaches?
Well, first and foremost, you become a part of the community. Okay. You have to understand what your community, you know, is that before you go into it. And then you try to become a part of that community, and you start, and you do that through building relationships. You're building bridges, you know, to connect with other people. So you try to find out who is this, and then who's this person, and why are they important? Okay. So for me, I tried at all levels, you know. I got involved with the lower school. I had my players go over, and we set up a reading program with the lower school every Friday. You know, I would have my players go over and read to, you know, the grade levels 1 through 6, you know, and then I would have community service was a huge part of my program. So I would have on my team, I would have community service projects by each class. So if we had, say, for example, if we had a senior, if we had 4 seniors on our team, then those 4 seniors together came up with a community service project. I don't care. You figure it out. What do you want it to be? Okay, coach, we want that community service project to be lower school basketball. Great. You're in charge of it. You develop it. You go over to the lower school. You figure it out, who you need to talk to, and tell them what you're going to do, and tell them why we're doing what we're doing.
And if I say, for example, I had six juniors, oh, coach, we want to do a shoe drive. Great. I think that's a great community service project. You figure it out how you want to do it, why you're doing what you're doing, and then you got to get people, you know, involved. So I empower them to be leaders, and then I, by allowing them to come up with programs, community service programs that they came up with, not ones I assigned them. So they're more readily going to believe in and buy in quicker because they're going to take ownership of it. And so you just got to become involved, and you attend other sporting events and other type of events. There was a play. I made sure my team was at the play, and I would oftentimes have my players become leaders in the school. I would tell them all the time, if you want to have a voice and change some of the rules within the school that you don't like, the ones that you talk about when we come here and practice, that's a dumb rule for the community. That's a dumb rule for the dormitory. I coach, why do we do this? Get involved in the leadership of the school. So at least you're at the table when this rule comes up and then they say, let's vote on it. You have a vote. And then you can come back to us and say, well, this is the reason why this rule is here. So don't sit over here and complain. Get involved.
Yeah, I think getting involved is key. And I think that it's something that is sometimes undervalued by coaches is the amount of involvement that you have in the community. I think if we look around and you see the successful programs, the ones that I've been around, they're programs that do engage with the community. They get involved with not just their school community, but they get involved with the greater community through, yes, as you described, community service projects, and just from being visible and going to an elementary school and talking and being a part of it. And I think that's something that, you know, that is invaluable, not only just as developing human beings, but you're also developing your program, and you're building in a desire in people in the community to be a part of what you're building. And I think it's hard to underestimate that. I know I always say that one of the things that was important to me when I was an elementary school student is I would go to, you know, my community high school's games, and I would watch those kids play, and they were involved in our youth program. And, you know, I had guys that coached me when they were in high school and I was in elementary school. And then I had guys that when I was in high school and I coached them in elementary school, and those are people that I still talk to today, that I have friends that I developed from that. And it made me, when I was in fifth, sixth grade, made me want to be a part of that program. I wanted to run out when the fight song was playing. It was important. It was important to me. And I think in a lot of places that's been lost because of just, you know, we talked about it earlier, of kids transferring schools and looking for this spot and that place, and the grass is greener here. And it's one of the things that I'm sad about, that kids don't have, and in some places they still do. And I'm probably overestimating the number of places where it doesn't happen, but it doesn't feel like it happens nearly as much as it did when I was a kid, where I knew from the time I was in, you know, again, second or third grade, I couldn't wait to be able to put on a jersey of the high school and get out there and play basketball. And that was important to me. And in a lot of cases today, I don't see that because I just don't see the same amount of community involvement and getting the school community and the greater community as involved in it. And I think that's something that, you know, again, if you're going to be successful, I think it's a great point for high school coaches to think about as they move into their job. Or even if you've been in a program for a while, the more you can engage your community, I think the better off you're going to be. What do you see as the biggest challenges for high school coaches today based on the landscape of how high school basketball is and how the grassroots basketball system is? What are some of the biggest challenges you think that the average high school coaches face on a daily basis?
I think keeping their players. I think, you know, players, like you said, you know, they transfer multiple times in high school. So I think keeping their players is a huge challenge. I think everything has a trickle-down effect on the things that we deal with, you know, in the collegiate, you know, level, trickles down to the high school level. So I would say, you know, social media, social awareness, those type of things are challenges as well. And nowadays, kids have so many people in their ear. You have a high school kid that also has an AAU coach, a grassroots coach, and now these kids have trainers. You know, so now you got three different people that are in their ear outside of family, and so that's tough to decipher. You know, what is the what? Who should I listen to? I say all the time. I say, you're standing over the 18th green for the mask. You don't want to hear a whole lot of voices,
right?
You want to hear that one voice that you've heard time and time again, and that you're going to knock it down. And so the same way with the kids in basketball. Take for example Kyle Guy. He had to make 3 free throws. Think about that. What if he shot the first free throw and he listened? He was listening to the high school coach. Then he shot the second one, listened to the AAU coach. The third free throw, he was listening to the to his trainer. Man, he'd have been awfully damn confused.
Absolutely, no question about that. That made me think about we had Coach Showalter on, and when he was on, he talked about sometimes when these guys, who especially were high level guys, and they get to USA Basketball training camp. And it may be the first time that, they come to the U-17 team or the U-19 team. And it might be the first time that somebody's critiqued their game in a meaningful way. Sometimes high school coaches are afraid to say to a kid, hey, you got to get better at this, or hey, you're not very good at this, or hey, you got to improve at this, because that kid might leave and go to another school if you tell that kid the truth. And AAU coach loses a great player and goes and place for some other AAU program, that's a guy walking out the door, that's dollars walking out the door. And so they may not hear the truth from their AAU coach, and they may not hear the truth from their parents, because their parents are lying just like we all are as parents.
Yeah.
And now suddenly they come where, Coach Show said again, they can't quit our team. There's nowhere else to go. You want to play for Team USA, you're not going to go renounce your citizenship and play somewhere else.
Right.
So, it's just, I think you're right that it is a challenge for coaches at the high school level to be able to keep their players in their program. It's a fine line that you're walking in a lot of cases.
But one thing that Coach Better, taught me early on was you got to coach the best player, the hardest. And you can't be afraid of, him leaving. Because guess what? If you coach him and don't challenge him and don't critique him, he's leaving anyway. So why not, coach him hard and tell him the truth and be very honest with him and coach up to what you believe to get him to play the way you know is best for him at that particular point in your program. And then if he decides to leave, he decides to leave. But at least you as a coach know that I did the right thing by this young man, and that way, because if you don't and you try to tell them what they want to hear, they end up leaving anyway.
Yeah, so, there's no doubt about that. I think one of the things that I always like to say is if you are, again, I think about it as in terms of a high school coach, but I think this applies to any level, is if you are doing a good job, you are going to make some people unhappy with your decisions. If everybody is happy with you, then you are not doing a good job, because there is no way that you can make everybody in your program happy. And so what you have to do is you have to make decisions that are based on what we talked about 5 or 10 minutes ago, based on that mission statement, based on that philosophy, based on those values that you put down on paper. And once you make that decision based on something that you put the time in to think about and understand where it is that you're coming from and what you stand for and what you believe in, there are going to be people that disagree with you. There are going to be people that aren't going to like that decision. There are people that aren't going to like to hear the truth that you may have to tell them.
Right.
And you have to be able to put your head down on the pillow at night and go to sleep. And I think that when you do that, you're going to make some people angry. And like you said, if you just try to tell them what they want to hear, they're going to leave anyway. It's not going to work out in your favor if you do that. So you might as well do it the way that you believe is right.
Absolutely.
And then you move on. And the people that end up sticking around are the people that you're going to want to pour more into anyway. And they're going to be more receptive to having you pour into them. And that's how you're going to ultimately be able to be successful. I think there's no question that that's the best way to go, as opposed to trying to cater to everybody's whims at a given moment.
Right. Absolutely right.
All right. We're getting close to an hour and a half, Kevin, and I know we probably could go for another hour and a half, but I want to start to wrap it up a little bit and just give you a chance to talk about what you're doing now at the University of Rhode Island, kind of your role there. Just kind of give us an overview of how you ended up in Rhode Island, what you're doing there, and what you see as coming down the pike? What's in the future for your program there at Rhode Island?
I arrived at Rhode Island. This is going on my second year. You know, I've been in coaching. This is, you know, my 35th year of coaching. And if you're in it long enough, you're going to get fired, reassigned, or, you know, like, no. And so I was at Pittsburgh, and our staff got let go at Pittsburgh. And so during that transition, I was involved with several jobs. And so my wife and I sat down, and we made a decision. You know, and we were looking for three things. We were looking for a program that had won and had the ability to sustain that with, and Rhode Island fit that mold. We were looking for a quality of life. Rhode Island, the state of Rhode Island, has been really stabilizing quality of life for us. And then third, we were looking for a coach that I had a prior relationship with that knew my talents, knew my gifts, knew my strengths, knew my weaknesses, and they wanted that in their program. And so we found that in Coach David Cox, who I've known, you know, when he was in high school at St. John's. And so I came to Rhode Island, and I'm really happy, you know, to be here, going into my second year. You know, my role on the coaching staff is, you know, to be a sounding board to Coach Cox, to share my experiences, because he's going into his second year as a head coach. So share my experiences of a head coach, some of the things that I've experienced in my career, to share those with him and keep him, you know, moving in a positive direction to build the program that his program and his image and his and what he envisioned. And then also it is to impact these young men and to take a holistic approach, like I've always done, to development, and pour into them and help us to be as successful as we possibly can be. And then, you know, finally, you know, here, I think we have a chance to be really, really good. I mean, last year we were 18-12 and we went on a 6-game winning streak to end the season. You know, Coach Cox and our players did a tremendous job of battling and finishing the season strong. And I think that we have a real chance to be one of the top teams in the conference again. A-10 is a competitive conference. Davidson, Dayton, VCU, and St. Bonaventure. So there's a lot of good teams and a lot of great coaches in this league. And I think we have a chance to be really, really good, because we returned our starting five from last year. And Dana Tate will be a contributor. You know, last year it was a 6th and 7th man. And then we have some outstanding freshmen coming in that will be contributors. And then we have two transfers that are going to be three transfers, two junior college transfer and one regular transfer from Georgetown University that can be really good for us and give us the quality of depth that we need to be successful.
All right, last question. When you show up for the very first day of practice heading into this season, obviously, we know we're doing lots of stuff in the off season as well, but the first official day of practice, when you show up, what is the first thing that you think about when you wake up in the morning on that day of the first practice? What gets you excited? What gets you out of bed? What drives you on that day to say, man, I'm so excited to get to practice and get this season kicked off? What is it about coaching that, and specifically coaching your team this year, that gets you out of bed and says, man, I can't wait to get to the practice floor today?
The opportunity to have an impact. You know, every single day that I have a chance to wake up and to go into work, and I look at it as an opportunity to make a lasting impact. So whether it's the first practice of the season or the last practice of the season, that's what gets me excited, is the opportunity to go in there and make an impact into the lives of student athletes that have been entrusted to our coaching staff here at the University of Rhode Island.
Love it. All right. Before we get out of here, I want you to share your contact information for people who are interested in reaching out to you after listening, or they just have a question for you. go ahead and share any way that you prefer for people to get in touch with you. And then if there's anything that we didn't hit on, you want to leave a little parting shot, you can do that as well. And then we'll wrap up the episode and thank everybody for listening.
Fantastic. My contact information is email is kevinsuttonbasketball@gmail.com. My website is www.kevinsuttonbasketball.com. My blog site is www.kevinsuttonbasketball.wordpress.com. And then my Living Trophies website is www.suttonslivingtrophies.com. And then I'm also on Twitter at Coach Sutton. So feel free to reach out and touch base, you know, with me, and I'll be more than happy to share anything that I have. I guess the last thing that I would like to leave with the listener is a great quote that my headmaster, Francis Casey, said every day over the loudspeaker. It says, if you treat a man as he is, he'll remain as he is. But if you treat a man as he could be and he ought to be, he will become what he could be and he ought to be. And that's Wolfgang Johann Goethe.
Fantastic. That is a quote that hopefully coaches who are out there listening are scribbling that down in their notebook right now and will share that with their teams. And I think that's a great way to wrap things up. Kevin, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It was an absolute pleasure to have the conversation with you. We can't thank Alan Stein enough for connecting us with you. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.